skeletal forms burn toxic green, vacant eyes lit with everlasting hellfire.
Hey, and welcome to the next episode of Let's Watch Scary Movies. I am your horror host, Jenny.
I am your horror host, Caitlin.
And we are here to talk about a scary movie.
Yay. Yay, it's shocking. One day we're going to be like, well, we're here to talk about Encanto, just to throw everybody off.
I would happily do a podcast on Encanto.
We have had the request to do a Pixar movie from our friend Joe. Yes. But we said it's going to cost him.
Yeah.
We're here for the horror, guys.
Exactly.
We're here for the horror. So I'm super excited about today's episode. I've been wanting to do this film for ages. It's in my top, my top 10, definitely, ever.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I love a period horror. So that element to me is very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to give our listeners some clues and then.
Because maybe. They can just read the liner notes.
Exactly. Okay. They can just read the liner notes. They probably have before we've done this. That's 2 weeks in a row we've done that.
Guess what film we're doing, because it doesn't list it right on the platform. Anyway.
We're smart. We're professionals.
The arsonist has oddly shaped feet.
Unique New York. Human torch was denied a bank loan. Right.
We were doing warm-ups before the show. Our vocal warm-up.
We were. It's been a little while. I haven't really spoken much today, so I sound like extra vocal fry. So yes.
So
Caitlin, are we watching a film, or are we talking about a film that involves baby goo?
Yes. Yes, we
are. Is there an evil goat?
There is.
Are there creepy children skipping around the woods?
Do you know what? Those fucking children. I thought I was going to murder those children.
Yeah, you may have guessed. You already know we're talking about The Witch.
The Witch. A 2015 Robert Eggers masterpiece.
Yes.
In my
absolutely.
Opinion. A New England folktale, which I love. So Robert Eggers, this was his first. I mean, I'm sure he probably did student films and shorts and things that I'm not aware of, but this was his first sort of major motion picture, and was followed, I think, 2 years later by The Lighthouse, which was an all black and white film that he did with, oh my gosh, was it Robert Pattinson and William Dafoe? And now this year, 2022, he has a new, and I think I talked about it in our New Year's episode. We were kind of discussing films we're looking forward to, and I said the Northman, although it's not necessarily horror. Anything Robert Eggers touches, to me, I want to see it. I just think he has such a fascinating perspective. And I know I had a total hard on last week for Ari Aster, but if it's possible, my hard on is even bigger for Robert Eggers.
Well,
I think the difference is that I did. Did you see The Lighthouse? Sorry to interrupt you.
I haven't actually.
Okay.
I know I need to.
You do, but I will say for me, like The Witch, I far, far, far prefer it. It's quite a huge difference in how much I enjoy The Witch versus how much I enjoy The Lighthouse. Whereas with Ari Aster, I really enjoyed Hereditary and I really enjoyed Midsommar. Well, we say enjoy. I mean, you know.
Admire, appreciate.
Admire. Yeah, as much as you can enjoy a really disturbing, fucked up film. Yes. But yeah, so I'm excited about The Northman because I just personally feel nobody can create an atmosphere quite like Robert Eggers.
Big words.
I have a little bit of a crush on him.
I was listening to an interview with him earlier today from not long after The Witch came out, I think. And it's weird because at that point he was talking, saying that he was doing a remake of Nosferatu and that was going to be his next film. But then I'm like, that can't have come out because he did The Lighthouse afterwards.
Interesting. Maybe he changed his mind.
Yeah. And then I also found another podcast episode that was just Robert Eggers and Ari Aster talking. And I started listening to it and I was like, no, I haven't got time. Like, I've got to do something else. So I've got that saved. I will send you the link and maybe you can watch that.
Yes, send me the link.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. I think that'd
my
be
two
a
re- loves.
I know they're friends. I know they're friends. So
I wouldn't be surprised if they have a little bit of like a friendly, you know, kind of competition going on in the horror realm. So, well, I mean, having said all that, I don't know what else we can say without spoilers. So should we get into it?
Let's get into it.
Now it's time for a breakdown.
So we begin. As you said earlier, a New England folktale. But just, let me just give a little warning now. My handwriting's hard to read. I think there might have been some partying happening when I was taking notes, but I have seen The Witch now probably about, I'd say, 5 or 6 times. Sometimes I just put it on because I just really, really like it. It is a little bit, and Jenny, you and I have talked about this as well, because many of our reviews thus far have a lot to do with kind of Satan or demonology, or not necessarily like religion, although that plays into it too, but you know, it's one of my favorite subgenres of horror. So yep. Not only is it a period horror, like a period piece, and I don't mean menstruation, it also, you know, has to do with Satan. And I feel like Satan was never more powerful than when everybody was freaking out about him all the time in like the 1600s, because essentially that's when this, I don't think they explicitly state the year that it takes place, but it's very giving me like the Crucible vibes. If you guys know the play, or if you're familiar with the film Winona Ryder, you know, back in the day, like a lot of that hysteria about puritanical religion, particularly controlling of women, controlling of everyone, but particularly of women. This film slots right into that, you know, time era.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere, or it was like 16 something. So yeah, you're right. That period of American history when people had come over, these people in particular had come over from England, and they had kind of founded a town that was supposed to be based on Puritan values. And we meet our family.
And they are at court. We've got Ralph Ineson. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Who is a fantastic actor, and I'm pretty sure he comes from a theater background, because if you've not seen The Witch, which I recommend you go do immediately, but it's the language, it's written in sort of old world English, so it's a strange combination of some very English turns of phrase mixed with a very new world America. I mean, if this is the period that I'm thinking it is, so I'm guessing kind of like 1600s, obviously like America's not even a fully formed country yet, so you've just got little areas, like little pockets of settlements. To me, they're British. They talk about home and they reference England, so because I think the oldest daughter remembers it. So you've got Ralph Ineson. I wrote he's all hot and righteous. he's standing off to, it's like a church.
It's the governor. It's the governor, and obviously the church, and the church basically run everything.
Yeah, and the line between the two is super blurred at the moment. Like, the church is the law, essentially. And so they banish him, and we're not exactly sure why.
It sounds I think it is because he is too devout.
Agree.
They keep trying to say things. And also, did you recognize who the governor was?
No.
It's the granddad from Anything for Jackson.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, who's quite like famous in his own right, but I can't think of his name. Yeah.
Julian Richings. That was his name.
So and so they banish
family.
Ralph Ineson and his family from the church. So all of the kind of support and community that they may have built up on any level within that village is now completely gone. And so they load up all their stuff onto their wagon and off they go. And I do think it's worth mentioning here about the music, because the music is all sort of the period. You're not going to hear any synthesizers. Everything, like all the instruments, if there's any kind of vocalization, it's all very of that period, which if you're going to give me a period horror, give it to me all the way. And so I'm here for all of that. So, they leave on their wagon.
Yeah. They head out into the wilderness.
And it's kind of as the sun is setting, and this is a brilliant shot because you just see the back of the wagon where the kids are facing out as the wagon moves further and further away from what is ostensibly the village, and the sun's going down, and the whole thing is just, it's just that he's just a master of creating that environment, isn't he? Like, immediately you get a feeling for the isolation and just the fear of the unknown. This is a new land for them, and it is the wild, wild west, so, you know. Anyway, off they go. And the shot that they show is of the forest as they reach their destination, where there's like a
They find like, so you see them like around a fire in the evening because they've had to stop. And then the next morning you get a shot of the dad, William, and he's lying on the ground, like praying. He like kisses the ground and looks up. It looks a little bit like he's like French kissing the ground because he's like, he's got his face smushed right in there. At first, that's what I thought he was having a bit of, you know, sexy time.
A moment. He's having a moment.
He's having a moment. But then I realized that they were all praying. And it kind of, as he sits up, the camera moves up and you see this kind of, yeah, it's on the edge of the woods. It's basically where they're going to set up home. This is their land. They feel like God's led them to this land. And then we get that amazing.
And they are on the edge of a forest.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, like choral soundtrack. And that's kind of the opening credits, basically. That's the opening scene.
Yeah, but that forest is a character unto itself. Absolutely. I mean, that shot of it is so foreboding and so chilling just looking at it. I mean, I would not want to go into that forest. I don't care if it's a springtime sunshine day, but this is obviously, again, it's kind of, I don't know if it's early morning that it's dark or late at night, but just the darkness of it and
yeah,
the music building up, it gives me chills just thinking about it.
It's so good.
Yeah, so then you've got...
Some time has passed.
So they've kind of settled in.
Yeah, they've built a house and a barn, and they've got, like, land. The mother's had a baby. There's now a baby, which there wasn't before. So you have the mother and father, who are William and Catherine. You have Thomasin.
I thought the baby was there. No. This is totally new information.
No.
Oh,
when they get banished. No, when they get banished, I swear, it's just Thomasin, Caleb, and the twins. Mercy and Jonas, because I you don't see a baby, or I didn't notice a baby, and a long enough time has passed because they've managed to build a house, they've got animals.
It's true. I'm sure you're right.
I think it's supposed to be kind of like a year's past or so.
Well, and given the age of the baby, that would completely make sense.
Yeah.
It's the baby that never ages. But.
Yeah, so we kind of come in and Thomasin is praying. It's a kind of amazing kind of close up of her face, and she's saying that she's sinned, she has been idle with her prayers, she has thought about breaking every commandment of God's commandments in her head. She's not obeying her mother and father, and she deserves to be punished. And we kind of get this shot of outside, and you've got the dad, people are doing things, and the mother's trying to work in the garden, but the baby's crying, so she calls to Thomasin and says, "Here, take the baby." And gives her the baby, and you kind of get the idea that Thomason's job is to do a lot of the chores and also to look after the children.
Well, yeah, she's the oldest, and she's the female, so it's going to be a lot of housework, a lot of laundry, a lot of looking after the other kids, 100%. Yeah, so she takes the baby to go, called Samuel, the baby's called Samuel, to go and play peekaboo. So she lays the baby on the ground, and she's kind of covering her face and playing peekaboo. And the way that it's shot is that it kind of starts off showing the baby, but then it turns to her face and you just see her putting her hands over her face and opening and shutting them, playing with the baby. And then all of a sudden she moves her hands away and says, "Boo." And her face and can I just say, Anya Taylor-Joy, this is the first film I ever saw her in. And I loved her. I thought she was a brilliant actress. She's also stunning in a very ethereal kind of strange way.
She's like, amazing face.
Oh my God. It's amazing. It's like angular, but these big doe eyes. Like, I don't know. She's gorgeous, but yeah. So, but she's also a very good actress. So when all of a sudden you just know something's wrong. Like, I remember my heart dropped.
Yeah.
And then it shows where the baby was and the baby's gone. Which of course is crazy because it was 2 seconds that she covered her eyes and there was no one around and the baby's like, I don't know, 6-7 months old maybe?
Yeah, I'd say about 6-7 months.
All of a sudden the baby's gone. And that's an amazing scene, I think, as well.
Amazing.
Because then he just leaves it. You don't even see any further reactions than that because the scene shifts.
Well, you see her running, she runs into the woods, doesn't she? And then you see the witch with the baby.
Yeah, then the scene switches to what you would just assume is the witch from the title of the film and the fact that a woman
in the woods in like a red cloak, and she's, you can hear the baby.
Yeah. So baby is sort of being rubbed by the old lady, and that's also very disturbing because you've got these creepy old lady nails kind of touching this pristine newborn baby skin. And then it kind of shows you like a montage of scenes. Then you see her using like a giant pestle and mortar.
So basically, you see her, yeah, like she's got the baby in front of the fire and he's naked, and you see that she's naked, and she kind of approaches and she's stroking, like you said, that scene with the old lady hands is like the creepy claws, and it looks like she's got a knife, and she kills the baby, and then you see, and I've got written down, I'm like, she's making baby butter. She's got the dead baby in the butter churner, essentially. Yeah, and it's horrific. I was just
and
like,
there's like slapping sound effects. It's, I just wrote a disturbing vignette of scenes, and that's pretty much exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And there's this real big kind of musical buildup as it's going on, and it's just kind of one disturbing thing after another. Now, I will say, from the old school witchcraft books that I have read in my time as the good little goth that I am, baby skin, there is like a thing about newborn babies. That's why they're always in horror movies, is like sacrificing the newborn baby. Obviously, this is, you know, what you might call like black witchcraft.
Yes.
Don't do it, kids. Don't do it. But
I will say, as a witch of almost, 25 years, I've never killed a baby and covered myself in baby butter.
No.
But especially not just to fly.
Have you not come across, I almost said recipes, have you not come across spells that talk about newborn babies? Because I totally have.
No, not in any real book.
Oh my God, we'll do a post on Instagram. Okay. I have my one of my mom's like witch books from the 70s talks about babies. Yeah, it's fucked up. I'll have to check with my mother. Good thing I'm here. But yeah, so yeah, it's very disturbing and fucked up. And you kind of, one thing that I think he does really cleverly, the director, is he doesn't give you exact answers. Never really. No. Until the very, very, very end. And even then, and we'll get to that, there aren't any, like, you're never 100% sure. So you're watching this and you're thinking, oh, we don't know that that's the baby. I mean, I think that you kind of hold out hope. Right.
Yeah. The first time I watched it, I was like, no.
No, that can't be.
We're only 9 minutes into the film. They haven't just quite graphically murdered a baby.
And again, they don't show the murder of the baby.
No, but I mean,
might
like,
be wondering.
The smushing and the
slapping sound effects.
They
go hard on the sound effects. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And then basically, you've got this like old naked lady rubbing herself in this blood, basically, and then she like starts cackling and like flies. Basically, she flies up into the air.
Oh yeah, that scene, great scene, absolutely wonderful scene, hard to stomach. But you've got Thomason the next scene, and she's sleeping, but it's really restless. It's like a really restless sleep.
Yeah.
And she wakes up as her brother is sneaking out in the morning. Is he going to look for Samuel? Is that
no? So yeah, you've got Caleb, and he's, you know, about 12, 13. And he's gotten up, and you can hear this just uncontrollable, like, sobbing coming from another part of the house, which is their mother, because obviously the baby's missing. And he's going out to start the chores to let Thomason get some rest, because obviously she's devastated that the baby's missed, like, she's lost the baby. And I think she's already feeling quite a lot of tension between her mother. Yeah.
Like, oops,
it's gone.
Left it on the tube. Oops.
But then you have before Thomason quite wakes up, you have the first uncomfortable shot of Caleb basically checking out his sister's tits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've got written down, you know, extreme repression leads to incest.
100%. Also, they're super fucking isolated. There's no other cute little Puritan girls for him to flirt with at church. So, you know, and he's probably, it's probably completely unspoken of. He has no idea necessarily. I mean, I'm sure he knows it's wrong because, you know, sin and all of that. But like, yeah, he just doesn't understand, I don't think, because he's young. I mean, she's probably, what, 15, 16, if he's 13?
Yeah, I know that it gets, that they talk later on, and Catherine, the mother, says to her father that she has begot her womanhood. So she's menstruating, she's bleeding. And she says that she's not a child anymore. And that's why she wants her to leave the house.
Right.
So yeah, okay. I'm gonna place her at, you know, 15.
16.
Yeah.
Area. Okay. Yeah, agree. I have in my notes that basically Caleb sneaks out and sees their dad. And their dad is kind of lamenting about the crops aren't growing and talking about how it wasn't a wolf. Meaning, I suppose, like, it wasn't a wolf that stole the baby.
Yeah.
Because I think in their poor, like, devastated minds, they're probably trying to put it together, like, this reality that somehow, even though the baby can't walk and she's right in front of it, that it's disappeared. Well, a wolf must have taken it.
Yeah, like, that's what they're saying. Like, a wolf ran off. And yeah, William's telling Caleb that they can't go and look for the baby anymore, because he says if it wasn't a wolf, hunger would have gotten in by now. So it's obviously been a few days. And he makes this like really, like, this man's pride and ego is very much his downfall. And you can see it already. Like, it's because of his pride and his ego that they've been banished out into the wilderness.
Absolutely.
And then as the film goes on, it almost triggers all of the family's downfall later on. But he has this amazing thing where he's talking about the wilderness and he's like, about the surroundings. And he's so arrogant. And he's like, we will conquer this wilderness. It will not consume us.
Mm. And I love the use of that word, consume.
Yeah.
And I think he alludes also to the fact that he says something like, we have to kill animals now, like instead of raising crops.
Yeah, their crops aren't doing very well. So it's like, we have to go and hunt. You know, so our harvest isn't going to support us through the winter. We need meat as well.
Right. Oh, I have a note here just about language, but I just think it's really believable. I really like that he chose to do the dialogue like this. I will admit that the first time it's very much like thou must make haste.
And I think they used a lot of court documents from this period to get the dialect right. Because obviously, yes, there are books and things, but to get a real idea of how people spoke, court documents were the only real records kept back then. So yeah
and it is very Witchfinder general, like if you're familiar with that time period and that story, which again is like the Crucible, it's like all this, any sort of the Salem witch trials, it's all very much this feel. Yeah, so for me, I wrote the language is mostly believable. I said the kids sometimes less so, mom and dad 100%. But it is lyrical and beautiful. And a lot of the dialogue is prayer, which I really like, because there's always this kind of question in the theater, right? When you've got actors on stage giving monologues, you always kind of have to ask your actor, or they need to know, who are you talking to? Sometimes it's themselves. Sometimes it's the audience. They're breaking the fourth wall, but very often they're talking to God.
Yeah.
And so I really like that you get a lot of insight into the characters' mental states because of their prayers, because we get to hear their prayers. We're privy to that information.
Yeah, I like that.
So yeah, it's between them and God, and we get the inside scoop on it. So another thing I noticed is that the forest in this particular shot, it's so still. There's no birds, there's no sounds coming out of that forest, there's no like little squirrels, nothing. It's just so still and foreboding. And again, like, stillness can be powerful, and that forest as a character is commanding that every scene it's in.
They did a good job, because I know they, to do the film on budget, they went to Canada, and I think at first, like, Robert Eggers was like, oh, this is going to be really easy, you know, Canada, the great untamed wilderness, but actually so much of it has been logged that and when they did find parts of it that were, you know, a bit more wild, it was the wrong kind of trees, because it's supposed to be in New England. Aww. So they did a good job.
They did end up filming it in Canada, didn't they? Yeah,
I think it's they had to travel, like, go somewhere really, really remote to get there. So they basically had to, like, just basically move there for however long it took.
Wow. Dad and Caleb, they have a bit of a heart-to-heart. He says, I love the marvelous well.
So I love that.
I really liked that line.
Yeah. Yeah, because William's taking Caleb out to check the traps. And this is where we find out, first of all, about the mom has a special silver cup. It's like a family heirloom.
Caleb, also, really quick. What is this? It says Annie Taylor-Joy egg embryo. I vaguely remember there's like a scene, isn't there, where it shows.
It's around this time. Yeah. So she's collecting, you kind of get shots of William and Caleb walking through the woods and then the children left on the farm. So you get like a shot of Thomasin carrying water on her head, and the evil little twins are being weird, creepy imps running around, just being creepy and weird. And and then we go back to Caleb and William are at the checking the traps, and Caleb's like, well, where do the traps come from? And William's like, oh, well, I had to trade some native people for them who were passing by. And it turns out he's traded his wife's family heirloom for these traps and hasn't told her. And he makes William promise not to tell his mother. And then Caleb starts talking about the baby, about Samuel and about God. And it seems that William's devoutness is that they're all born sinners and they have to prove themselves throughout their life, work to get forgiveness. And obviously Samuel was only a baby. So Caleb's like, oh, well, is he in hell? You know, he didn't have a chance to work off his sin. And then he starts to get panicked and he's like, what if I die? Will I go to hell? I haven't had time to kind of make up for it yet. And that's, yeah, that's when William kind of says that great line about, what was it, loving him.
I loved him, Marvel, as well.
Which was really, really good. And then, yeah, then Thomasin is back on the farm and she's emptying the chicken coops for eggs. And she drops one and it's full of blood and there's a chicken embryo in the egg.
How come when we make scrambled eggs, we don't see chicken baby chicken?
Because we only get unfertilized eggs.
That makes sense. Thank you, Jenny.
That's okay.
It all makes sense. So
chicken husbandry with Jenny.
Well, I was like, I've never seen that. But I was wondering what is sort of the symbolic meaning of that, because clearly there is one, because you don't put that shot in the movie for no reason.
No, I mean, eggs, he uses quite a lot of symbolism from kind of, especially old English paganism. So we have, and European. So obviously you've got the egg and then later on you have all the shots with the hare. And that's quite an old, well, especially in Celtic paganism, the hare is a symbol and so is the egg. And the egg is obviously a symbol of purity and innocence and things. And it's like when it cracks open and it's full of blood and death, that's a bad omen.
Okay, so we're back in the forest with Dad and Caleb.
Yeah.
And he loses the dog. I think the dog like runs off or something.
Yeah.
Right? He shoots something. The dog goes to get it. Dog doesn't come back.
It's the hare, isn't it?
And so they find the hare. Yeah. And the dad shoots his eye. He accidentally like
hits himself. Dog,
backfires and like hits his own eye.
I love that it takes them like 5 minutes to load the gun.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Super old school.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you kind of flash back over to Anya Taylor-Joy, aka Thomasin.
Thomasin. She's mucking out the goats. So she's mucking out the goat shed and the twins are chasing the goat, Black Phillip.
Black Phillip. What a name.
And they're chasing him. Basically, you know, you don't ever want to be around an angry goat. And this goat is angry and it's loose and they're chasing it. And Thomasin's trying to get the kids out of the way as William and Caleb return to the farm. And immediately William's just like, oh shit, this goat's going to kill my children, and is trying to wrestle it back into the pen. And he gets covered in mud and, you know, because he falls in the mud and the twins are laughing because they're evil little fuckers. So yeah, the mum, Catherine, comes running out and she is kind of very angry at William and Caleb for leaving the farm, for leaving so early before she got up. She thought something bad had happened to them. And you kind of see that like Thomasin is, there's this tension between Thomasin and her mum. And, you know, part of it is obviously because you can tell that Catherine blames Thomasin for losing the baby. But of course, I think a lot of it is also the fact that Thomasin is now a woman in her eyes and is therefore kind of a rival. And, you know, William says something to the children, like tells them to shut up and they don't. And Thomasin immediately is like, you know, like, mind your father, disciplining them and standing up. And she's almost taking over her mother's role. And Catherine bristles to this, and so I love the tension you get between the two of them at this point.
Also true, and I also think it, not only does she blame her and see her as a rival, because I agree with both of those, particularly like the blame about things, but I think also she kind of then becomes a scapegoat for anything else that goes wrong.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So the dynamic starts to alter obviously immediately with the loss of Samuel, but that then continues because now through different characters, you've got lies and deception coming in. So you've got the dad who's asked the son to lie. Then you've got the son who does lie to the mom, I think, to cover something up.
So while they were gone, when she's like, you know, why did you go? And obviously they can't say to check the traps because the mom doesn't know about the traps. So Caleb's like, oh, we went to get apples to surprise you. I thought I saw an apple tree, but I didn't.
That's it. And so not only do you have this massive change and shift between the mother and the daughter, but then, of course, you've also got... And I also think there is... Going back to what you said earlier about Thomasin, like, having her period and being a woman, I think that the mother automatically associates, like, sin with that.
Yep.
Probably because she thinks back to her own experiences.
Yep.
But also because of the way the Bible wrote young women to be... you know, the bearers of sin and a temptation to men and just in general, a harbinger of sin.
Exactly.
Anyway, you know
what? Heartbringer.
Heartbreaker. Heartbreaker.
I was going to start singing Mariah Carey then, but I won't.
We will later.
Yes.
So, so now you've got all these lies, and then you've got the mom blaming Thomason, obviously. And then you've also, I wrote, bro, stop looking at your sister's tits.
Yeah. So, because Catherine has sent Thomason down to the brook, the stream, to clean her father's muddy clothes. So she's there, like, and Caleb comes down, and Caleb's like standing down, and he's like, look, and she kind of catches him looking at her boobs.
Really quick, didn't the dad kind of start to disrobe like in front of them? And I think there was a little bit of awkwardness in that part too, when she tells Thomason to take her father's clothes, he kind of starts undressing right there.
Yeah.
And I think that makes the mom feel uncomfortable too. Like, oh, what's happening here?
Yeah.
Of her grown daughter. But yeah, no. And so then she goes down by the water to wash clothes, as you said. Caleb's brother checking out her boot.
And then has a tickle fight with him. Like, have you read Flowers in the Attic? I mean, the two evil, like, twin children, the brother and sister.
Oh, my God. VC Andrews on to something here.
Yeah,
oh my God,
absolutely.
So true.
Then we get the evil twins, and it's Mercy, and she's hiding, watching her older siblings tickle each other, and she starts.
So, for the record, they're not like evil. We keep calling them evil because they're generally just kind of assholes. But I think it's worth noting in the progression of the film, they're just kind of two bratty little kids. There does come a point where something shifts, and we'll talk about that. But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like they're not. We shouldn't say evil because they're just assholes.
I'm not sure. It's like, I love the fact that in the costumes, they're in like these little, they're all in like these puffy clothes. So they look as wide as they are tall.
I know, they do.
Like these weird
like Lego characters.
Yeah. Mercy is cackling, and she's like, oh, I'm the witch of the woods and I'm going to eat you. And Thomason and Caleb are like, you know, shut up. And then Thomason gets wound up by the twins, and she kind of stands up and she's like, I am the witch of the woods. And Caleb's like, stop it. But she's like, starts coming at Mercy, and she's saying all these things. She's saying that she's, you know, we were scared, and that she wants to eat her. And she gets on her, and starts kind of hitting her. And yeah.
Well, I love this scene because children are great as sort of the manifestation of this idea that you're now blurring a little bit sort of fantasy and reality. And you've not really had that before. Like, so the little sister says she's the witch of the wood. And then Thomason says she's the witch of the wood, just to scare her back. And at least in my mind, the first time I watched this, I'm thinking, I don't know about those twins, they're fucked up. But, you know, she's kind of been presented as our protagonist, Thomason. And so in my mind, I'm thinking like, but we've seen everything that she's done. She hasn't, you know, she's a fairly reliable narrator, as much as there is a narrator. Like, she's not the witch of the wood. She's just fucking with her brother and sister, trying to scare them.
When I first watched that and she started saying that, I'm like, no, don't say that. Don't even joke that in the era you live in. Do not.
Right by the forest. They're like literally right next to the forest.
Yeah.
But you know, but this is also... But you start to question their agendas because of this. It's so cleverly done. And it's just in like a second, just in 1 second, everything switches. And you're like, wait a minute, I don't actually know anymore, because you have this blurring of reality. And then you all of a sudden have a kind of switch up in the personalities. Not that we know any of these characters super well, but, you know, it does seem like she was kind of pushed by her brother and sister. She's so annoyed by them that she starts talking like this. But yeah, so you've got, now you have questionable agendas, and you have characters acting out of sorts, and then we come back and they're all sitting at the table. I love a family dinner scene just full of tension. In some of the greatest movies that there ever were. The dinner table full of tension. So what's for dinner? Tension and family dysfunction.
Well, yeah.
I like family dysfunction for dessert. So, yeah. And you've got everything's lit by candles. So again, you've got this beautifully dark just scene. It's just shot like it's this wide open shot of the table with the dad at the head of the table, and he's praying. And yeah, I just wrote A++++.
Yeah, it is a beautifully lit scene. I love the fact that he doesn't try and use anything more than candles to light the scenes. Mm-hmm. He keeps it so authentic, and it just it creates such a vibe that you couldn't fake that with, you know, artificial lighting. You just couldn't.
No, agree.
And yeah, so they're having dinner, and the mum basically, Catherine accuses Thomason of stealing her silver cup.
This fucking silver cup.
Yeah.
It's got to be like worth so much money. That's all I could keep thinking. So.
Yeah. So she's saying about Thomasin, have you lost, where's the cup? And Thomasin's like, oh, well, it's on the cupboard. She's like, no, I looked there. I said, oh, well, it must be, you know, somewhere else. She hasn't touched it. And the dad just goes like, oh, you know, she says she hasn't touched it, Catherine, shut up. That's basically all she says. And then the mum makes a dig about losing the baby as well. She's like, oh, you know, you lost the cup, but you lost the baby. And I love that William at no
Mom's
point.
Mom's going to hold that over your head for all time.
Yeah.
You're like, never being forgiven.
William doesn't sees that, you know, his daughter's getting blamed for something that he's done. And he doesn't tell her the truth. He just kind of basically half-heartedly tells her to shut up. And then they're all, you know, everything's getting a bit heated. And the dad's like, no, we're all sinners, so we're going to fast for our sins. And they send Thomasin out to kind of bed down the sheep. And when she goes, she kind of hears or senses something. And when she goes into the, see the sheep, we see the hair from before.
But she doesn't know that it's the same hair.
No, she just sees a hair that's in with the sheep. And I like this because this is like they've gone to the wilderness and they've created a sanctuary for them. So, you know, they've created buildings and a barn and things. They've created a safe space. They've pushed the wilderness out of their space. And I like that this hair coming in is kind of the wilderness, the darkness of the woods creeping in to their...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Reclaiming like some territory. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. Well, and it's very creepy. And if you know anything about paganism or like demonology, like that, you know, Satan can manifest itself in a multitude of animals. A hare is one of them. Obviously the goat is maybe the most well-known one. So Satan is all around us, I feel. So then you've got this scene between the mom and the dad, where the dad says, we must turn ourselves towards God. Because the mom thinks that God has cursed the family and they're being punished, basically. I'm guessing because they were banished. I think she's kind of trying to now blame the husband and like turn this on him.
But I mean, he says this thing to her when he's like telling her that it's okay the baby was killed because they've been so blessed that all their other children have survived so far. He's like, God has never taken any of our children yet. And it's like, I mean, one out of five in those days are great odds. But still, she's just lost her baby.
Yeah, you know, literally lost the baby in a way that's so disturbing. Like, that you have no idea what happened to him. And that's like the worst thing I can think of.
Yeah. You know? And she's saying that Thomasin, this is where she says about Thomasin has begat her womanhood and she needs to go and serve another family now. Basically, you know, her use, they don't want her around the family anymore. And she's also saying, you know, the corn is rotten, so they're all going to starve.
But this scene is so harrowing because interspersed with this conversation, you see the kids upstairs and lying there in darkness and probably starving because now they're having to fast. And so they're just listening to their parents argue.
Yeah.
And they can hear Thomason's everything they're listening. Saying about getting rid of Thomasin.
Yeah.
But I mean, this, the layers that he creates here, this nuance in the relationships of the family, I think, the lighting, the music, like the use of darkness, the religious oppression as a mechanism for manipulating in some way everybody's feelings of guilt and shame and what constitutes sin. And like you said, all of that oppressed, not just sexuality, but emotion as well. So this Caleb decides that he's going out to hunt or he's going out.
Yeah.
To look
so
for this dog
he's going to go out and he wants to find the dog and. Or they've got the dog and the dog goes out with them. And yeah, he's like, basically, he's going to sneak out and check the traps again to see if they can
get some food. He doesn't want Thomasin to go, but she convinces him.
Yeah,
she's
like, I'll wake up mom and dad and tell them if you don't take her. And they have this amazing conversation while they're going through the woods. And Thomasin's on the horse and Caleb's with the dog and has a gun. And they're walking through. And Thomasin's talking about glass and about glass windows. And Caleb has no idea what she's talking about. He doesn't remember glass. And she's like, we used to have glass windows. Don't you remember? Like probably back in England.
Yeah,
we used to have glass windows.
And
she's talking about like the way the light kind of, it was so pretty, the way the light would shine through it. And we would lie on the floor in the sunlight. And basically he's been out in the wilderness so long, he doesn't remember like real civilization, I guess.
Yeah, just some home comforts.
Yeah.
Some glass in the window.
Yeah.
So this effing dog runs off again and Caleb runs after the dog and she's on a horse, isn't she?
Yeah, she's on the horse.
And so the horse goes to go after them, and she falls off and hits her head. And so then the scene kind of cuts the family, and the family's out looking for them.
I love this.
Because they're both missing.
Yeah. I love that you've got, you know, the mum and dad walking around, and yeah, they're calling for Caleb and Thomasin. And then they've tied the twins to the fence. So they're just on like a bit of string tied to the fence, like straining.
Like leashes. Yeah. Like, you're not going anywhere, those little bastards. So, and this scene I think is extremely scary because it kind of cuts to Caleb on his own and he's praying. So under his breath, he's repeating this prayer. And then he hears the dog crying. And so he runs towards the dog. And then it kind of cuts to the dad finds Thomasin. And again, these scenes are kind of cut.
Yeah, they're interjected against each other. With each
other. You've got the dad finding Thomasin, who had kind of blacked out, at the same time as Caleb sort of stumbles across a hut in the middle of the woods.
He hears things and he's walking, like trying to find the dog. And he kind of finds this house, in the trees, and it's the witch's house. And we see this woman come out of the house, and she's beautiful.
I wrote sexy little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, she's got like her long dark hair and this beautiful red cape, and yeah, she kind of entices him in. And the music, I've got written down here, the music is just insane. It builds up so much at this point that it's almost unbearable.
It is. It swells to such a level that it is almost unbearable. And so she kisses him, but you see that the hand on it's kind of on his head is like the old lady. It's the old lady hand. And so then you again cut back to the mom and dad, and they're arguing because the dad's going to go back out to look for Caleb.
Yeah.
And the twins are begging him not to go. And he finally admits to taking the cup.
Yes.
And so the mom says, I knew you were false.
Yeah. So she's angry with the father. And she seems to finally be happy with Thomasin, because Thomasin's, you know, after they've had their big fight, and Thomasin's like, oh, I'll go and deal with the sheep, I think, or something. So I'll go.
She's like going to bed down the goats.
Yeah. And it's absolutely hammering it down with rain. And Catherine kind of gets to come up and like strokes her head. And the first time and last time we see her be kind to her eldest daughter. And she goes
really
out.
Is. Yeah.
And when she's out there, she finds Caleb naked, walking like all weird. And he kind of collapses in the rain, and she like screams for her parents. And then we have them, like they've taken him up into the attic, which is where the children sleep. And they've like laid him down in front of the window. I mean, they've gone full hilt with all their medieval or 1600s medicine. They have put poultices on his chest and they're bloodletting.
Yeah.
That's basically all they had.
They really have gone all out. Yeah,
they've gone all out.
I think it's worth mentioning that. I think it's worth mentioning that somewhere in here, the mom is also mad at the father because Caleb lied.
Yes.
And now she's turned the son into a liar. Yeah. And the dad has kind of like nothing to say to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So as they're upstairs doing all of their religious, you know, medieval cures, the twins accuse Thomasin of being a witch and putting the devil into Caleb. That's how they kind of phrase it. You put the devil into him. I wrote here, blood comes out when she tries to milk him. So I'm guessing at some point she's milking the goat.
The three children. Something. Yeah. So the I've got the imps. The imps and Thomasin are in a barn. And Mercy's trying to milk the goat. And Mercy calls her a witch.
Yes, saying that, that's what it is. Yeah.
And then as soon as that kind of happens, the milk turns to blood. She squeezes the teat and it's all blood. And I love this scene because she knocks over the pail. And the blood runs into the hay, and it's like it's tainting their ground. And we go back to the mum and dad fighting, and the mum saying, Catherine's like, I want to go home. And it's like, no, you are home. And she said, no, I want to go back to England. It's like she doesn't even want to be out in America anymore. She wants to go back to England.
She's desperate and grieving and sad. And she admits, since losing Samuel, that her heart has turned to stone.
Yeah. Then we go back to a kind of a shot which mirrors the very first shot we have of Thomasin. Well, not the very first, but the first in the house, where it's a close-up of her face and she's praying, and she's basically talking to God. It sounded about a sex dream she had about Jesus, the way she was talking about it. But then she's like, but now she can't feel him. And while this is happening, She's just the way
you never talking. Not want to be able to feel them. I'm just going to throw that
exactly,
out.
Exactly.
You know what, though? They do say something like unnatural providence. I think that's the way that they're like phrasing it or something. But I will say that Jesus and Jesus Christ Superstar, the 70s film, I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Okay.
He's very good looking. I highly recommend you watch Jesus Christ Superstar.
I think I've seen it before. I mean, right now, when my husband takes his hair out, his hair down, the way he dresses, I do call him 90s Jesus. So I can't say Jesus isn't hot because
your husband's Andy, rocking the look.
Yeah, he's, Andy is rocking the JC.
He needs like robes and sort of some
sandals. Well, years and years ago, I bought him a Jedi robe dressing gown, which is like a long, light brown thing. And that's what it was. Every time he wears it and he stands up, I'm like, Christ has risen.
Praise be.
Praise be. The Lord has risen.
That's some unnatural providence right there.
Yeah. So he does scream.
Well, Dad goes to salvage the crops. So he's off somewhere, and then Caleb starts screaming.
Yeah,
and he's saying, "Get an axe, cut off her head. Get an axe, cut off her head." He starts repeating it, and the dad comes running in at this point, and he's clenched his jaws so tightly that the parents are trying to pry his jaw open. And during this, like, it's kind of pandemonium. So you've got Caleb sort of screaming and praying, almost like speaking in tongues. And then you've got the twins start freaking out because the parents are like, come and pray, and pray over Caleb's body. And so Thomason comes over, she's praying with mom and dad, and the twins, they're like, we can't pray. She's witchless.
Yeah, they say, first of all, they accuse her of being a witch. And then they start saying that she's stopping them from praying. And Caleb starts kind of praying. They all freak out a bit. And I love this because you have this amazing scene with Caleb. He's 12 years old. He's a young actor, and he's in this very almost uncomfortable position where he kind of raises half up, like a half sit up.
Yeah.
And this whole shot they did in one, and apparently they had to rehearse it so many times because it's an incredible performance. It's quite a physical performance for a young boy. And to do all of that, and like the way that, you know, he has to give this speech, because he has this amazing piece of dialogue where he's talking about Jesus or God lifting him up and kissing him and holding him. And I've got written down, Caleb has a Jesus orgasm and dies, because that's essentially what it is.
You've got the twins accusing her of being a witch and they can't pray.
Yeah.
Which is to me like a full circle crucible moment, because that's essentially like the whole climax of that play. I can't pray. And then Caleb wakes up, like he sits up, like you said, and he gives this, it is an incredible performance and this kind of monologue. Yeah. Where it's almost like he's experienced rapture.
Yeah.
And then I also have that he spits up a cherry. He spits
So you know when his mouth was sealed shut and they open it, he kind of vomits up a half-eaten apple.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Thank God you're here with all your farming knowledge. You can identify crops and tell me about chicken husbandry. So I wrote, it's a prayer off. I wrote, very disturbing. This is excellent child acting.
Yeah.
I wrote that he has a rapture. Basically, he has a rapture.
Yeah, he's like coming, he's showing up.
Coming into God's arms.
But I have a question for you.
He does almost have a God.
Yeah. Do you think in this moment that he is him and he's seeing God and he is saved? Or do you think it was the devil kind of mocking them, whatever the witch put into him when she kissed him, the evil? Do you think it was the evil kind of mocking them with their how devout they are by showing him having this moment and then dying?
I think it's a great question. And I think it sort of then begets the question, what did the witch do with him? Like you can see the use for the baby because there's a spell there.
Yeah.
She's doing a spell and she needs the fat of a baby or whatever it is. And so, okay, that makes sense. What is she like? What is the purpose of her luring Caleb into the house? Cause she does lure him and then seduce him in some way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily sexually, although she does kiss him. And that is, I think, playing up on the fact that he does have all this oppressed, you know, sexuality. And
yeah, he's, you know, and he's becoming a man. He's probably going through puberty and, you know.
Definitely. So he sees a beautiful woman. Okay. So there is that level of seduction as well. But like, what happened in the forest? What does the devil need with a 13-year-old boy?
Yeah.
That, well, to me is kind of the first question.
Yeah, when she kisses him and then he has his apple in him, and, you know, the apple being a symbol of the first sin in the Garden of Eden, and it's almost like he throws up this apple, and it's almost like he's bringing the evil into the house. Because before this, all of the kind of creepy stuff hasn't happened in the house. It's all been outside, on the edges, either in the woods or, you know, Thomasin was on the edge of the land when the baby went missing, that kind of thing.
Well, now that you've said that, which is a super good point, I almost see it as like his body rejecting the sin, mm-hmm. and him coming to Jesus in his last moments. Now, obviously, I'm an atheist, so I don't think that would really happen, but in the fantasy of this story, or maybe he believed it so strongly in his mind, that's what he thought that he saw.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a really good question. And so now that you bring up the apple, yeah, I think he rejected it. He absolved himself of his sins and he was welcomed into Jesus's arms.
Oh, I like that. I'm like, no, it's the devil.
No, it's the devil who's mocking you.
Yeah.
But he does then immediately die. So
yes,
he has this rapturous moment. He lays back and he stops breathing.
Yeah. And Thomasin tries to kind of comfort her mother, and her mother banishes her, like, screams that she wants her out of the house because the twins have already, while Caleb was dying, the twins have been like convulsing on the floor. Like they're having some sort of seizure and saying that it's Thomasin. So she runs out the house and William runs after her father, and she's on the floor sobbing, and he kind of holds her and he hugs her. And he says that she's going to have to tell everyone, you know, she's a witch. He won't. He's like, I can't hide. Come tomorrow. I can't hide this. Because basically he's going to take her to, you know, the church, and a trial's going to happen because he thinks that she's a witch and that she may have done this and the children are right. But he doesn't know for sure because of the twins. So anyway, and I love this because rather than being all timid at this point, she just snaps and she causes him, and like, she basically tells him that he's an egotistical prick. And she says, you can do nothing but cut wood. Because throughout all of this film, whenever anything's gone wrong or he's stressed, he goes out and he cuts wood. At one point, he's cutting wood in the rain. You're not going to have to light that. It's soaking wet. But it's all he can do. He can't grow crops. He can't hunt. He can't stop his children from being taken. All he can do is cut wood.
Well, and this is also representation of the full breakdown of the family dynamic.
Absolutely. And at this point, Thomasin is like, well, why aren't you pointing the finger at the twins? You know, they're the ones that are always running around talking to that goat, talking to Black Phillip. Basically, like, they're creepy as fuck. Why am I 100%. The first? Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
And the dad's like, right, you're all evil, or you all might be evil. So he nails them into the barn with the goats.
He does. He puts them in the barn.
Yeah.
And again, it's still raining, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, still raining.
It's like horrible outside.
Yeah. He locks the twins and Thomasin in the shed with the goats and like nails it shut. And he says, I am infected with the sin of pride. And he's praying, you know, praying for his children.
So you do have this part where I wrote, dad loves chopping wood. He blames himself. And he has this monologue, this prayer, you know, with God. He's on his knees, kind of sobbing, praying. And then you switch to the mom. And you see the mom.
Oh, God.
I don't even know if I could tell.
This scene was really hard for me.
Oh, my God. So she's alone in the room. And it's just firelight again.
Yeah,
it's
lit they're asleep in bed, and the mom gets out of bed, and like their bed's downstairs, so it's just surrounded by a curtain. And she kind of pulls the curtain, and she lights her candle, and she sees Caleb and Sam. And
Caleb's holding the baby,
and she thinks they're angels, and she hugs them, and there is this incredible like whispering voice that tells her not to wake her husband. And the voice is basically saying, you know, saying it's Caleb's like, oh, mother, we want to come visit you more. Would you like that? And she's like,
well,
yes.
He's speaking with this creepy, saint voice.
Whispering.
Caleb is. Yeah.
It's this very like soft, it's an amazing voice, but like, whispering voice. And obviously Caleb's not moving his mouth. This voice is just appearing in her head. And it says, and she's like, yes, I'd do anything to be able to spend more time with you. And it's like, oh, we have a book for you. Basically, like we have a book that you need to sign. And while this is happening, the kids in the barn, they hear a bang on the roof. And we go back to Catherine, but she hears like a baby crying. And she's, we'll sort the book out later, but Sam needs a feed. And picks him up and sits down and she's basically about to breastfeed the devil. I'm actually holding my boobs right now.
It's so disturbing.
It's so horrible.
Basically, you've got inside the barn, and again, these scenes are kind of intercut. So you've got in the barn, you've got the twins breathing like in tandem, which also is just sort of heightens the creep factor. So they're just at the exact same time. And then you kind of see this old lady, the witch of the wood, I'm guessing, feeding from the goat or the
she was doing barn. Something. And yeah, you have this cackling old lady witch is in the barn with the children and the goats.
And then everybody screams.
Yeah. And then we go back into the house to see the mum laughing. And she's sat on the rocking chair laughing while a raven pecks her nipple off.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And she thinks she's feeding the baby.
She thinks she's breastfeeding the baby and she's not.
My
boobs hurt. Just thinking
we're
about it.
Holding our boobs.
Yeah.
It's painful to watch.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm sending soothing vibes to your boobs.
I'm sending them right.
Yeah. Oh, God, no. And then it cuts and it's the next morning and you see the mother lying in bed on her side and she opens her eyes and she's got this white nightgown on and there's like this blood over one boob. But the dad doesn't notice. The dad kind of climbs out over her and goes outside and sees the barn is destroyed but the children were. And Black Philip is loose and he stabs the dad.
Like so the goat. Really quick, the livestock have all been mauled.
Yeah.
Thomason's on the ground.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where the twins are, but he basically walks out and is immediately gored.
Yeah.
In the stomach by Black Philip.
Yeah.
And I just wrote, this escalates so quickly. Like this whole part right here is like 5 minutes long, maybe not even. So he gets gored by the goat and he's of course like screams, collapses. The mom comes out and just sees like the madness and she's just confronting Thomason and accuses her basically of being a whore. So you have this kind of like mother-daughter rivalry come to a real head here, which is another trope. It's a trope that's present in a lot of things, not just films, books and everything else. So then she basically attacks Thomason and Thomason is trying to defend herself with a knife. I mean, where did she get the knife? I can't remember.
I wasn't sure because when Black Philip gores William,
maybe he dropped it. Yeah,
he picks up a weapon, like it was either an axe or a knife, and then he drops it, and then he's like faces up to Black Philip, and he has this amazing line which is corruption, thou art my father, and the goat rams him again and kills him. So I was thinking that it must have been that knife that Thomason kind of picked up. But yeah, so basically her mother's on top of her, like beating her, and she's screaming, and the mother saying that, you know, she blames her, saying that Thomason killed them all and she's a witch. And then, yeah, she just picks up this weapon up, whatever it is, and she kind of just lashes out at her mum and cracks her in the face. And she has this like cut that's dripping with blood. But she stops for a second, but then she carries on. And all of this blood's like pouring into Thomason's face. So she just starts hitting her kind of repeatedly to stop her mother from killing her until in the end she's killed her mom. And she's just lying there on the floor holding her dead mother and crying. You know,
so she's killed her mom, like you said. I think you were just about to say everybody's dead, which you're right. And you get this beautiful wide shot of the mom just like dead on top of Thomas, and she's just lying there. Yeah. So she goes inside and sits at the table and she puts her head down.
Yeah.
And when this is Thomason, and when she wakes up, it's dark. Quick question. What happened to the twins?
I have a theory that I'll tell you a little bit later once we've got past.
Okay. But they're nowhere to be found.
They're nowhere to be found now.
So she sits up and it's dark outside. And this is also a beautifully shot, very, very creepy scene. There's no light. It's super dark. Yeah. Like she doesn't light any candles or anything like that. And there's a sound of kind of like chimes or bells.
Yeah, like a tinkling sound.
And so she goes out to the barn and Black Philip is there just kind of hanging around. So she conjures him to speak to her. She says something like, I conjure the Black Philip.
Yeah, that's exactly what she says. She kind of follows Black Philip into the barn. She says, Black Philip, I conjure thee to speak to me.
Question for you, Jenny. Oh, question for you.
Yeah.
The voice of the devil here. Yes or no?
Yes.
It's such a hard one to get right, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, basically, you hear a voice. You can't see Black Philip speaking. And I like that they didn't go that route because it would have made it silly.
Yeah.
So you just hear this voice. And the voice of the devil is like this low, whisper. I agree with Jenny. At first I wasn't sure about it because I think anytime you're like doing Satan's voice, it can go one way or another.
Yeah.
It can easily go badly. So I do think he got it right on this. It's very like raises the hairs on the back of your neck kind of voice. But to me, it's like confirms like the devil is real. The book is real. Or she's a completely unreliable narrator who's crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, she says she doesn't know how. He asks her to sign the book.
Yeah, basically, she has these amazing lines where he starts whispering. He's like, "What dost thou want?" And she's like, "Well, what can you offer?" And he's like, "Would thou like the taste of butter? Would thou like a pretty dress? Would thou like to live deliciously?" Which I love, I have that line as a print by one of my favorite artists. And yeah, I love it. And he's basically like, "Well, if you sign this book, you can." And we see the book. You see kind of the shadow, like there's a shadow behind Black Phillip that looks like a man.
Oh, yes.
With like a hat.
But she says, she's like, "I don't know how to write." And he's like, "I will guide thy
hand. I will guide thy hand." Yeah, you will. Sexy Satan.
So hot. Yeah. So
yeah. Satan can guide my hand. Oh, yeah.
So she... Well, you don't see her sign a book or anything like that.
No, no.
The next shot is of her walking into a forest where she sees a ceremony, a witch ceremony.
Yeah, so she's walking out into the woods. She's naked. She's following the goats. And at first you can hear this like whispering. It becomes like shouting, chanting. And there are a bunch of naked women around a fire. And they're all kind of chanting and dancing around this fire. And she joins them. And she stood with them and they all start to float up into the air. And then we have this incredible shot of Thomasin. She's just in front of this like pine, I think, this really tall pine. And everything's dark and she's like lit up and she's like white. And she just floats up to like the top of this tree. And she's almost like flowing with the shape of the tree. And she's laughing and smiling.
And then it goes to a blackout. And then you've got this, it's like an a cappella choral, like choir, that starts singing as like the credits roll.
Yeah. Like at the end of Midsommar, my last notes were exactly the same. Good for her.
Fuck that life. Go live with Satan. You exactly. Might have to occasionally kill a newborn baby, but you know.
Yeah. Your best life. I was going to say before was I wasn't sure if they made kiddie butter with the twins and that's how they all floated.
Well, I was thinking, so obviously there's multiple witches around the fire here, and I think most of them are naked and they all kind of fly up. So it's obviously some kind of ritual or something. But I was wondering, the witch of the woods, like kind of what was her agenda? Obviously she serves Satan, or Satan is active in this area. And so do all these witches serve Satan? Is that kind of how you saw it?
Yeah. So these were all people who had signed his book, all women who had thought, fuck this, fuck the patriarchy. I'm going to go join Satan's sisters.
I'm off to be a witch.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was kind of like, was the devil after? And my other question was, do you think that the devil was after Thomasin the whole time? Or was it less specific?
I think it might have targeted her because she was the perfect age. You know, she'd left the innocence of childhood. And
she was female.
She was female and she was having all these impure thoughts, as she said. My question is, do you think any of it was real, or do you think they were all just batshit crazy from eating moldy corn?
I think it was all real but I say that not without any evidence necessarily, just that it makes me enjoy the movie more.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm saying.
And even that theory about eating moldy bread with like making them trip on acid and all that stuff. Like, I don't believe that either. I believe that the hysteria that rose out of, you know, the Salem witch trials, and I know there were similar ones over here, all had to do with power, authority, oppression, shame, guilt, inner conflict. Like, I think it had everything to do with that. And with little girls feeling like they had no power and all of a sudden being given tons of power and how they could abuse that power. And so to me, I've said it a million times, like the worst things in the world are the atrocities that humans commit against each other. So this was just, you know, because in the Salem witch trials, like I know in the Crucible, there's a character called Tituba and she is their slave servant. And she's one of the only Black people in town. And it's claimed that she brought over her voodoo from, I think she was from Haiti or something like this. And So that's kind of part of where that, and that's all court documented as well, because that's what the Crucible is based off of, you know, the Salem witch trials, which were well documented. And so she's Black. So these little girls are like, who can we easily accuse that it's not going to cause me too much of an inconvenience? I'm not going to lose any friends or my sister. Oh, we'll blame the Black slave. And so they're abusing their tiny amount of power that they've all of a sudden been given in these courtrooms. All eyes are on them. They have all this attention and all this power. And so the moldy bread story can fuck off, because I think that like humans are just kind of like bad people ultimately. But yeah. I mean, so I love this movie. For me, this is 5 stars, easy, done. And I do not give 5 stars often or easily, but to me, this is one.
Do you prefer The Witch to Midsommar?
I do. Mm-hmm. But some of that's personal. It has nothing to do with one necessarily being better than the other, because I think you could argue for both of them, just that I personally enjoy The Witch more.
Yeah.
I enjoy these period horrors. I said that at the beginning. Like, I mean, there's no weak acting in either of them. There's beautiful shots in both of them. Like, they both take you for different types of rides. But I just, when it comes to what I enjoy watching more, which is why I've seen it as many times as I have, The Witch, hands down.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, 5.
Thinking face. Jenny's thinking face. 5 for you? Ooh, we have a unusual...
Have we ever both given 5s?
Yeah, we have. The first Halloween, we both gave 5.
Yeah, okay.
We both gave 5 to Get Out. We both gave 5 to Scream.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask you about quickly, and it might be something we go into more at a later date, but there's a term that I keep hearing about, and it's kind of a bit contentious. It's elevated horror. And a lot of the films that we really like seem to be getting bundled. So films like Get Out, Hereditary, Midsommar, The Witch, they all seem to be falling into this elevated horror category.
I mean, so really quickly for the audience members out there, according to the internet, the knower of all things, elevated horror is essentially a subgenre which relies on dramatic elements and overarching themes instead of your popular gore fests and slasher scares. Mm-hmm. So what? It's essentially saying that because there's some sort of plotline and character development, that's what makes it elevated.
Yeah, and I don't like it.
I don't really like it either. Well, this is also perhaps maybe not the greatest definition of it.
Yeah, I think it's something we might go into a little bit later on a different episode, because I'm aware we've been talking for quite a while about this. But it's just something that keeps, when I've been like reading about, you know, because obviously we've done Get Out and we've done Midsommar and now we've done The Witch. And in my readings, it's something that keeps popping up.
No, you're absolutely right, actually. It says that this is perhaps more the definition that you're talking about. It refers to films that attempt to upset you emotionally, tending to focus on dramatic elements over blood, gore, and jump scares.
Yeah.
Which I think that's fine, but I don't like that term.
No, to me, it sounds like, because obviously it's never been cool to like for critics and things to like horror films. So for me, it's like they're like, oh, well, these aren't just, you know, horror films, they're elevated horror. So we're allowed to like these ones. We're allowed to talk about these ones, we're allowed to do well, you know, because they're.
But wouldn't you just call it like psychological horror or like dramatic horror, which are other subgenres? Yeah. Elevated to me sounds elitist. I don't like that.
Exactly. I just wanted to see if you'd had any thoughts on it.
But I stumbled across a different term. Maybe it was like new as an NU horror or something like this, kind of referring, I think, to the resurgence of more mainstream horror films. Obviously, as horror aficionados, we know, and you listeners probably know too, horror has always existed. And in fact, when I was working in film, I was told by a producer that it's actually the least risky type of film to make, because you will almost always make your money back on a horror, because there is that core audience that loves horror and will see anything horror.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah. Know? We'll watch some absolute shit sometimes.
For sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were calling it like new horror, and you just because I guess of the mainstream part of it, just it being more like, oh, it's a big opening weekend, and not just for Scream 2, but for things like The Witch or Midsommar or, you know.
Yeah.
That's interesting though. We definitely should dip into that topic.
Yeah. Again. Since we've done quite a few films that fall into that category.
And all the ones you've named, I really like. So maybe I am a fan of this.
And I would potentially even put films like Saint Maud into that category.
And I think we're just upping the standards here. You can't get a bunch of like girls in bikinis and throw, I don't know, what was the guy in Slumber Party Massacre? He had like a guitar.
The Driller Killer.
The Driller Killer. Like, and throw like a killer drill into the mix and call it a movie. Like, people know we want, you know, well thought out plots. And as I said, character development and not jump scares. I mean, listen, I'll take a jump scare here or there, but for the most part, they're not scary. It's the long run. Yeah. And we're going to do The Eyes of My Mother, because if you want to talk about an emotional film that fucks with you and disturbs you, that's up there.
So. Okay.
But it's in black and white, so it might be considered elevated, because that's very, you know, artistic.
Exactly.
So, well, anyways, 5 stars across the board. I love The Witch. If you haven't seen it and you've listened to this, I don't know why you have, because it's ruined it. But see it anyway.
Go and see it. It's brilliant. And maybe watch it again, because, yeah, like Hayden said earlier, it can take you a little while to fall into the language. I know I struggled a little bit, and I watched it the first time at yours, Caitlin, and because it's such a dark film and your living room is so light, I remember I couldn't even see half of what was happening.
I know.
And trying to watch it and trying to listen to it, it was quite difficult. And then randomly bought it on Blu-ray. Oh, I did buy it on Blu-ray, and we watched it, and it was great, me and Andy. And then I brought it down for me and Caitlin to watch at hers. And we spent 25 minutes wondering why we couldn't get it to work. I feel like this story has to be told, Caitlin.
I have a DVD player. It's new. I don't understand why this isn't working. We were like blowing on the disc, like old school Nintendo style, wiping it off, blowing inside
and
the machine.
And it was really about 20 minutes before we were like, oh shit, this is a Blu-ray. You don't have a Blu-ray player.
I actually have like the oldest, shittiest version of a DVD player that there could be. So it's not play Blu-rays. I'm not cool like that.
I love how long it took us to figure it out. But yeah,
clearly
so this
we're
was
very
like my third or I think this was my third viewing. And I would say that it grows on me every time I watch it.
I just think it is a masterpiece. I really enjoy it. I love everything about it. I loved the ending. And, you know, horror movies, it's hard to nail an ending. It's really.
Yep.
You can build it and build it and build it, and then you can fuck it all up at the end.
Yeah,
and I feel like,
you know, Robert Eggers and Ari Aster are very, very good at endings.
Yeah, I'll give them that. So, yeah, I love this film. Easy, easy 5 stars. Like, I'd watch it again right now. I just love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, well, join
as
us,
always,
won't you?
Yes, as always, join us online. Rate, review, subscribe, follow. Send us messages, send us emails, give us film suggestions, because
talk
we have
to
a few
us,
ideas.
You. Are
yeah,
you
we
out
do
there?
Miss you. Are you there? Do we need to start singing again? Will that bring you
is
back?
Is anybody out there? Yeah. We'll sing for you if that's what you really want. But I'm glad we did this one. So.
Me too. I'm a big fan, and I'm glad I've had a chance to watch it again and really pay attention. And yeah, it's such a great film. Go and watch it. Even if you've seen it before, go and watch it right now.
Watch it again. Yeah.
Are you watching it?
I'm watching it right now.
How about now?
Right now. Now. I'm watching it right now. I've just turned it on.
Me too.
A New England folktale. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Guys.
See you later, guys.
Brothers Keg, take us out.
Bye.
Bye.